You're listening to the Fat Dude Digs Flicks Movie Podcast Network. And now, the Criterion Break. Greetings and salutations, everyone, and welcome to an all-new episode of the Criterion Break. I am one-third of your host trifecta, Andy, the resident fat dude of Fat Dude Digs Flicks, joined as always by my two partners in crime, the Robins to my Batman, the pilots of my spaceship. I don't know. First, Derek Varenk. Derek, how you doing, buddy?
Hey, doing great. I'm glad you're going down the line here and talking to each one of us, just like Marion Cotillard. That's great.
I just want to make sure that I get how all of you guys feel about hosting this show. Blake Innathan, would you like to continue hosting the show?
Yeah, since I've actually voted for you to lose your job. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Blake needs that bonus.
I get it. It's hard to argue against it. Judging by our banter, you can tell that one of the films we will cover today is 2 Days, One Night. We'll get to that in a little bit here. But if this is your first time listening to the Criterion Break, hello. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. The Criterion Break is a podcast where three friends discuss their love for the Criterion Collection proper and the Criterion Channel. This month's Criterion Break episodes kind of center around my Movies You Should See series that is currently playing weekly at the State Theater in beautiful Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I should probably say the beautiful State Theater in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Put that beautiful where it belongs, since we are buried under sandy, dirty, disgusting snow and ice. So the state is still gorgeous. So there's that. But yeah, so we're kind of covering those two movies, the final two entries in that series, one of which is 2 Days, One Night, and then the bonus entry, which is Safety Last. So we will talk about those here in a little bit. But before we kind of get started with that, we'll talk about some movies that we've been watching. Blake, I'll just ask you right away, is there anything other than the featured movies that you've watched this week that's Criterion related or adjacent?
I don't believe I did.
Okay. All right. And Derek, you mentioned that there was one that you had watched. What did you check out?
Yeah. So it's a whole story. So Last time you'll remember on the Criterion Break, we talked about another of Andy's picks for his State series, which was Ozu's Tokyo Story. Now, when I watched this movie for the show a couple weeks ago and logged it on Letterboxd, a good friend of mine named Ryan, who I know from my days when I was heartily attending the Century 14. He used to be a staff member there. He saw that I had logged Tokyo Story and asked, "Oh, this is neat. Is this your first Ozu movie?" And I said yes. And he responded with, "Well, I know your sense of humor, Derek, so I think you should watch Good Morning. I think that'll really click with you." And so right before we recorded tonight, I finally popped that in to have a little bit of discussion here quick. For those of you who don't know what Good Morning is, this is a movie that Ozu made in 1959, or 6 years after the aforementioned Tokyo Story. At a high level, it's set in like mid-50s suburban Tokyo, following this upstart family as the rise of consumerism begins to grasp their area. Namely, their neighbors have a TV and this family doesn't have a TV. And the boys always go over to the neighbors to watch TV, and they start pestering mom and dad to get a TV, and they refuse. So the two little boys go on a silent strike until they get what they want. It's a very charming family comedy. It only clocks in about 90 minutes. It's very of that 50, kind of like a 50 sitcom tone, in the sense that it's got very bright colors, got a very jaunty score to it. And it also has some very irreverent pots of humor. So to explain this, all that I knew going into this was the back cover summary from the Criterion disc, which I own. And so as the movie kicks off here, we've got these boys, they're walking on their way to school, and they do this little game, hey, push my forehead. Push his forehead, he farts. And that becomes a significant motif over the course of this movie, is not just the boys, but other various characters farting. And I will admit, I was not prepared for that. It's like, did I just hear a fart? I went through this whole, like, existential crisis watching Tokyo Story, and now we're going to fart humor and a kid who keeps crapping his pants trying to fart, and what's going on here? But it is a very charming and a very delightful movie. It's very cute, especially what they got to play the little kid in it, like the 6 or 7 year old, whoever he is. Very adorable. Obviously some overlap in the cast with the aforementioned Tokyo Story, because the father of the family is played by the grandfather in Tokyo Story, which was a little jarring to me at first, but I got used to it. But yeah, it was a very breezy watch, and I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Yeah, I haven't watched that one in quite a while, but I remember it being, you know, because Tokyo Story is so somber. Like, the whole film is so very somber. And then this is Ozu's fart joke movie, where it's just there are so many farts throughout this movie. And I'm like, what is this? How is this? I guess farts are always funny and always have been funny.
It's a universal concept.
Yeah, it's a pretty delightful movie. I don't know that I like it as much as Tokyo Story, but I think it's in a completely different realm as Tokyo Story.
And yet very stylistically the same. Yeah. You've got all your locked off shots. You know, you've got your characters looking dead eye straight into the camera. Very much cut from the same cloth, but again, to your point, couldn't be more totally different.
Well, fun. I am glad that you watched that one. It's just, yeah, I'm going to have to go back and rewatch it too, just because it's such a like you said, tonal shift there from Tokyo Story. A lot of fun to watch. I forgot to mention a movie on the last episode of Criterion Break that I did watch. I've tried this year, and I have not done exceptionally well so far, but I've tried this year. I started with great intentions to do a Criterion challenge to kind of make myself watch some of the movies that I own that I have not seen. And originally I picked like 52 random titles to just kind of watch. And then I found like somebody else had made a Criterion challenge. So I kind of geared my selections towards their criteria, but also tried to make it as many movies that I had that had never seen in that to fit them into that list. I always enjoy making these lists. It's the following through on them where I usually suck. But in week one, I did a great job, and I did watch Quadrophenia, which I had never seen before, based on the rock opera created by The Who. And man, this is a killer movie. Like just about like rebellious youth, teenage, like rockers. Like it's about a couple of like, gangs or different gangs or culture groups that kind of go at each other, in like, I believe it's late 1960s, early 70s England. And like, it is just a, like, blitzkrieg of energy. And I really dug it, had a really good time with this one. And it's a movie that I've owned for a very long time. Like I want to say probably as long as it's been out, been a part of the collection, but hadn't gotten around to watching it. And I'm glad that I did. It's, I was anticipating, That it would be a rock opera because, you know, that's how the album is set up, but it is more based off of the story of the album, instead of being, you know, much like Tommy, where it's just song after song after song, and every scene kind of goes from one song to the next. This is a story, and there are a couple of songs kind of peppered in there. But yeah, I quite enjoyed Quadrophenia, and would highly recommend it to people who like coming of age stories, especially. So that's the movie that I watched. That's not the two featured movies of the week. So let's dive into the first of those two featured movies. The first one is 2 Days, One Night, and it's directed by the Dardenne brothers, starring Marion Cotillard. And this is a movie that I have selected as part of the movies you should see. So I think what we'll do is I'll get your guys's like impression, like first impressions, kind of gut reaction to the movie. Oh, go ahead.
How about we find out why you chose it first?
Sure. Yeah. I'll talk about that first. So I'll be totally honest with you as to why I chose this one first, or why I chose this movie. Main reason I chose this movie is because another one of my movies was not available. But this was the first thing that I kind of like replaced it with. And the reason for that is that I selected another movie that starred Marion Cotillard. And that movie was called Love Me If You Dare, which is very difficult to find. In a way that you can play it at a movie theater. You can find it on like iTunes and Vudu, places like that. But in order to, you know, play it at a movie theater, you have to have a particular digital file that'll play. And that just wasn't happening. So we couldn't secure that one. And I selected this one because she was in it. I think Marion Cotillard is a fantastic actress who I don't feel gets the credit that she deserves in America, because I feel like a lot of the English language roles that she has taken just haven't really showcased just how phenomenal she is. And I wanted a story that I wanted to pick a movie that was one that I think, hasn't really had a wide audience, especially here. I think in South Dakota, this is not an incredibly well-known movie. I wanted something that kind of fits that idea of, somebody told me about this movie that I would never have seen otherwise. And this is kind of the impetus to get me to watch this movie. I like that it's simple. I like that it's like simple in its structure, but yet very like complex in its performances. And I think what it's trying to accomplish, it's something that's very relatable, because it's like, if we were all put to the task, the general story of this film is that there's somebody who is about to be laid off. Their position was put to a vote against the other employees getting a 1,000 pound or 1,000 franc bonus.
Euro.
Sorry. My money's bad.
Okay.
They either would get the bonus or, you know, she would keep her job and they couldn't have both. And so in her way to salvage her job is to go door to door or call these people, the other employees, and say, hey, they're going to do a revote. Would you vote for me? And I think there's that notion of, would we sacrifice something that would benefit us if it were to benefit someone else? And I think it's a question that isn't easy to answer, because I think we all want to think that we would do the right, you know, do something for another person. But when push comes to shove and we think about all the things that, you know, how it would benefit us, it would be very difficult, especially if that was such a necessary part of our livelihood. It would be very difficult to, you know, turn down the extra money. And I think that's one of the reasons that makes this movie so compelling, is that it's hard to fault everybody for their decisions. There are some people here where you want to punch them. Like you want to smack them around a little bit. But there are other people where it's like, I get it. Like, I would have a really hard time with this. And I think the movie does a good job of kind of dealing with that. And I just, it was a movie that I selected because I felt like if I couldn't get my first choice, this was something that I felt people should see because it's a smaller movie that around here, I don't think a lot of people know about. So that's my main, I guess my main series of reasons in a rambling kind of way. Mm-hmm. So for you guys then, what did you guys think of this movie? Blake, I'll start with you on this mm-hmm. one. What were your thoughts on 2 Days, One Night?
I really enjoyed it quite a bit. As you said, it's a very simple movie. And I don't know. Have you guys watched any other Dardenne movies at all before?
I saw The Kid with a Bike, and that's okay. The only other one I've seen before.
Okay.
None for me.
Okay. So the Dardennes have this, like, they did this thing, how do I say this? They would do this thing with the camera where, like, the camera follows the person, like, main character very, very closely. They made a movie, like, 20 or so years ago called The Sun. And, like, the camera's literally right behind the main character the entire time. You see the back of his head for most of the movie. And the other movie I saw was called L'Enfant, which is about a couple of young parents in Paris who are absolutely terrible parents for two newborn. But where I'm going with this is like, those are the only two movies I've seen, and I was kind of like worried that camera aesthetic was going to be used here because I particularly didn't really grab me as much as I hoped it would. But thankfully, this one doesn't really play into that. It's sort of like, it follows Cordia. What's her name in the movie? I forget.
Sandra.
Okay, we follow Sandra pretty closely, but like we're given room with her. We get a little bit of space as we follow her. And I sort of like saw this movie as like a little mini like thriller in a way. Mm-hmm. I was talking about with my mom this weekend, and I was telling her about this movie, and I didn't tell her what happened, but I told her like what it's about in terms of like what this lady has to do. And when I got done, she was just like, that sounds really agonizing and what was the word she used, like intense. And I was like, yeah, I mean, it really was like you're just sort of like, it's like a ticking clock movie. And it's also like a movie that sort of like really allows you to empathize with a lot of people in the movie. Not just Sandra, like there's her husband and like Andy, like you said, a lot of people who tell her no, like you're kind of like, oh, I understand, you know, like times are tough for people and they can't say no. So I sort of looked at it as like the Dardennes were able to make this thriller out of seemingly like just a really like ordinary situation that someone has to go through, while also kind of like explaining the backdrop of like a company choosing profits over its own employees' livelihood.
It's interesting how it kind of like you're on the like a ship on the water in rough tide.
Yeah.
Like, cause something will go really smoothly for a moment and it's like, oh yeah, I'm with this. This is great. And then it's chaos. Like mm-hmm. there is one scene in particular where she goes to ask, there are two guys who are there, and her asking them ends up getting the two guys in a conflict with each other. Mm-hmm. And it's just this like outburst of emotion and rage that just like how does she go forward from here? And I think the scene kind of shows why she goes forward from there, just, you know, talking with the one gentleman who ends up siding with her, that it's like, okay, well, I'm gonna keep, you know, I hate that this happened, but you know, he went through this and I gotta keep fighting. So yeah, I think I hesitate to use the word simple, but like an ordinary situation, something that everybody could possibly go through, it makes it incredibly tense. So, Derek, what were your thoughts on this movie?
Yeah. Yeah. Blake beat me to it because if he didn't say ticking clock, I was definitely going to say ticking clock. And I think part of it is just because how elegantly it kind of lays out kind of the ground rules right off the bat for the movie that we're about to see. Because we get that scene, you know, where they're rushing to catch the boss before he leaves work on Friday afternoon. They get him to agree to this vote. And then it basically sets up the premise of, okay, it's Friday afternoon. They're going to have the secret ballot revote on Monday morning. So we've got all of Saturday and all of Sunday to get this done. And of course, it sets up the math very elegantly because it's like, okay, there are 16 other coworkers and two of them are already on board for Sandra. So you're kind of counting it down in terms of like, okay, we're up to like seven people that she's talked to. So she's got so-and-so left. Mm-hmm. And then also, of course, along the realms of the camera work, because it's, how should I phrase this? When I originally was going to log this on Letterboxd, I was half snarkily going to just post a review that said, quote, The Office, because there's a lot of work uncomfortability in here. And even in particular, the fact that this movie is structured so that Marion Cotillard's character has to keep having this conversation and start from scratch every single time.
Yeah.
And if I'm not mistaken, pretty much every single one of these conversations plays out in one unbroken take. To kind of help emphasize that, you know, there's really very little respite that you get from these conversations, except for like the one or two times she's talking on the phone and we only hear her side of the conversation. But otherwise, the people that she's talking to, you know, throughout these conversations, they're players in the conversation. Of course, they're, you know, often kind of throwing out, you know, their rationale of, you know, like, I didn't vote against you, I voted for the bonus, or right. I need this money to pay off my debts and so and so. And, you know, it takes a lot of confidence, you know, to keep the variety, as it were, in these conversations, you know, because you could easily see it getting, I mean, at a base level, it is repetitive, you know, because she has to go to every single one of these people and have this conversation. But then they always find ways to spice it up. Like you mentioned, the visit to the father and the son that ends up in a little bit of a violent altercation. Mm-hmm. As well as, you know, going through like running into people on the street, you know, accidentally, or going to the guy who's coaching soccer, you know, and trying to get him to be convinced. You know, for a very straightforward narrative, it finds a lot of variety in that, and it kind of helps kind of propel you for your interest in every single one of those conversations as a result.
I think that's a really good point, because for I can't even remember now who I was talking about. It might have been Seth Vargas on the other show, where we were talking about, you know, you put characters in a room, like they're just going to be sitting in a room having a conversation. How do you make that interesting? In this instance, how do you make the same conversation interesting, you know, 16 times, or however many times that she has to have this conversation? And it's because you add a variable to what someone is dealing with that, you know, influences why they would lead one way or the other. I really liked the conversation that she has with the guy who coaches soccer, because it's like he's been dealing with the guilt of voting against her, and now he has a second chance. And it's kind of like, you know, all of that boils over during their conversation of like, oh, I'm so sorry. Like, I didn't mean to. I'm glad, you know, I will definitely vote for you this time. And that's how you, oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I didn't have anything.
Oh,
no.
Okay. So it was just like, you know, it's nice to have that, the kind of dramatic spark that textures the conversation a little bit differently, because otherwise, you know, she just go door to door 16 times and it's like, yeah, I'll vote for you. No, I'm not going to. You have to have those little, the influences of their life. What is it that would possess them to vote a particular way? And how do you make it dramatic in the sense of like in a conversation? How do you give the conversation something to make it like where you want to keep watching, where you want to keep have your audience completely invested? And I think this movie does a really good job of keeping that that tension going, because, you know, once she succeeds in one conversation, she has to move along to another conversation, and what obstacles are going to, you know, either cause the person to tell her no, or what are the reasons why they would say yes. And I just think, yeah, I just think it's a really fascinating adventure that we're taken on, from the most mundane of circumstances. Yeah, really, really interesting slice of life. I want to talk about Marion Cotillard first, because for me, like, she was nominated for an Oscar for this movie, and I think certainly deserving of that. While I know that we're not, you know, the Oscars are not the end-all be-all of movies, it's always kind of nice to have that accolade. How did you feel about her performance in this movie? Derek, I'll start with you. Like, was she kind of something that kept your interest through the entire movie, kind of felt kept you ingrained, or ingrained in what was going on?
I would say yes, because in this particular movie, she's playing a very ordinary character, for lack of a better word. You were kind of talking earlier about how, you know, her American roles have kind of short shrifted her. And I think a big part of that is because she's often kind of called upon to be kind of like this mysterious or elusive figure. Yeah. You know, I think of like Inception or The Dark Knight Rises, or even Allied, where the whole premise is like, oh, can you really trust her? Is she really a spy or not? You know,
right.
And that's kind of become the crutch that she's kind of become casted on in these. And I was reading some notes about how the Dardens, in casting her, tried to aim for that, or try to give her that platform to have kind of this ordinariness. Because I think there was like a big deal of mention of like, prior to this movie, the Dardens hadn't really made a move to cast superstars of her stature in their movies. And so it was, in some circles, it was kind of seen as a little bit of a risk for that, because there's almost that, like, she could almost overpower the movie. But she's, you know, she's very believable, you know, as this wife and mother. You kind of get on her side, you know, obviously just the emphasis of, you know, trying to save your job, but also conveying, you know, the struggles with depression, which we haven't talked about much yet, but I'm sure we will.
Yeah.
Kind of fleshing out that character to see fully where she's coming from and what she's trying to fight for in these circumstances.
Yeah. Yeah. I think she gives a performance that could go too far into melodrama, just dealing with the things that she's dealing with. But I feel like she handles it pretty gracefully. Blake, what were some of your thoughts on her performance here as the central figure of the movie?
Yeah, I made no secrets about what I think in our group chat. Like, I just think she's one of the best in the world. Mm-hmm. And you know, she kind of falls into that, like, I mean, I'll just kind of like go adjacently to what Derek said. She kind of falls into that thing with like what American studios do with foreign like superstars, is like to have no idea what to do with them.
Yeah.
Like Mads Mikkelsen is just like, when he comes over here, it's just like, he's good, you know, he's right. Great, but like
stock
like
villain,
like another round. He's so fascinating to watch, and mm-hmm. I guess I should say I've not watched Hannibal. I hear he's great on that, but my yeah. point is like, I looked at Marion Cotillard's American credits, like, you know, preparing for this, and it was just sort of like, she's really had no like big superstar role where, like, you know, she's given something to do, like something meaty like this to do.
Yeah.
Or Love Me If You Dare, or have you guys seen the movie Rust and Bone?
No.
Matthias Schoenaerts. Yeah. Excellent movie. Highly yeah. recommend that as well. Has an incredible Katy Perry needle drop in it. Ugh. But she's very good in that as well. And it's just like, we don't get these great big roles from her. And like, even though this is not like a big flashy role, like in a way it kind of has like a lot of meat to it. You know, like mm-hmm. she plays a woman who we haven't even discussed why she's trying to get her job back.
Yeah.
You know, she was depressed and she had to take a leave from work, and you know, it was work approved, but you know, her company sort of figured out that like, we kind of don't need her, you know, like yeah. we can do this without her.
Yeah.
And you know, excuse me, sometimes it's not really about that. It's about, you know, just helping out a fellow human being. And, you know, I have to admit, at one point, I was just kind of like, you know, there's a bunch of scenes where, like, she gets really overwhelmed and she has to take these pills and she's starting to lose it. At one point, I was getting a little like, all right, you know, like, you need to step up here. And, you know, to be fair, she does at one point, and it's kind of like a Rocky Balboa moment where, you know, and she has no more pills. And her husband's like, you have to take this head on. And yeah. It's so powerful to watch her do that. And I knew she got nominated for an Oscar, but I sort of forgot about that.
Right.
So when watching the movie, or I should say when I finished the movie, I always look up, like, you know, the trivia and the award stuff. And I was like, oh, she got nominated for an Academy Award. And I thought that was super cool that, and I don't remember the whole like narrative of that year. If it was an Out of Blue nomination or if she got like a SAG nomination or what, but this is just like a, I don't know. It feels like a this would be like an A24 movie nowadays, you know, like, yeah. this would be like the indie movie performance that everybody would be talking about. And I you know, it's one of her best for me.
Yeah. This is the movie where, you know, and it's sometimes the case where if something gets nominated, that's almost as good as a victory because it means that more eyes will get 100%. On that.
Yeah.
And I absolutely. Think with this one, it's like, you know, if this movie kind of flew under the radar for most of that year, I think, you know, I know that critics definitely enjoyed it that year and it was something that they talked about from festivals. But I think for the wider audiences, it was nice to kind of see, like, oh, well, you know, now people that go through those nominees and are like, I've got to check this off my list.
Yeah.
Like, this is the one to do it. Let's talk about how this film kind of handles mental illness, because I think I feel like it handles it really accurately. It is a depression is a thing that is, first off, it's not the same for everybody. Everybody handles it in a different way. But the way that she handles it is, it's like she is crawling. Like, at the very beginning of the movie, it feels like she's kind of crawling out of this pit. Like, it's like, you know, she's ready to go back, and she says that she's ready to go back, but you can tell there's something there that's still, like, you know, she wants to get back to work, but there's still this shadow hanging over her. And then as the events kind of transpire and she's told that she's, you know, losing her job, you know, her initial reaction is just to kind of retreat, like, back to, you know, back to the bed, like, I'm done, like, I'm throwing in the towel. And then she has to fight, and it's like this back and forth where she's, you know, sometimes it's two steps forward, three steps back, or, you know, finally she'll take a big leap forward and then something will happen and it'll knock her down, to the sequence of, you know, we spoil the movies here, but to the scene where she's in the bathroom and she's taking all of the pills, which, you know, then as soon as she takes the pills, she is told good news and she's like, just so you know, I took all the pills. And, yeah. You know, then cut to the hospital. They, you know, force her to throw up, cut to the hospital, and then she's out, which I, you know, I don't understand. I guess I don't know how the Belgium medical service works, but I would imagine that if you attempted suicide by taking a lot of pills, they might keep you overnight. Just for observation, possibly have a behavioral health specialist talk with you, you know, just to see if this is something that you're at risk for trying again. But again, I don't know what the healthcare system is like in Belgium, so I can't really judge. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I thought it handled it in a way where it was like, you try and shake it and there's still this weight. And even when you find a success or find your strength, you're still kind of wrestling through it. And I thought she conveyed that really well. What are your guys' thoughts on how this handled mental health? Blake, yeah, we'll start with you on this one.
Yeah. I mean, as someone who's had depression before, I thought it was a very empathetic look at people who sometimes just find it really hard to get their, you know, their clothes on in the morning. And yeah, like I said, I think Courtyard is one of the best in the world, and her ability to make you feel for Sandra, it's a really powerful thing. Yeah, how do you guys view this movie? Like, is it a movie about overcoming adversity, or is it about the workplace stuff? Like, what, like, when you guys were watching it, what type of movie was it, or was it multiple things, or how did you perceive the movie?
Derek, you go ahead.
Sure. I guess there's a part of me that kind of saw it as in terms of these workplace relationships, you know, trying to explain, you know, you work with these people every day, but how much do you really know them and how much of a relationship you have there?
Right.
But there's also a little bit of the futility into this. I mean, if we cut all the way to the ending in the quote unquote happy ending where the boss is like, good news. I'm going to give the bonus and I'm going to keep you, but I can't bring you back until the contracts for one of these other guys expires, but then I'm going to bring you back and I'm going to get rid of the other guy, but I'm going to bring you back. And it kind of shows, like, even at the end of the day, it's all about the headcount and the numbers and trying to just fit that in there, which of course leads to Sandra just taking off and not accepting the offer to come back. It's a little, I wouldn't even say if it's maybe a Sisyphean climb, maybe. Because even though, you know, after all that fighting, it's not exactly a happy ending for everybody, no matter what.
Yeah.
And she ultimately feels like, well, if it's not going to be a happy ending for someone, I might as well take on that and just get out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, I guess, first to answer your question, Blake, I see it more as I think I see it more as a workplace movie, but I think it has to handle all of those other elements in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're there throughout the whole thing. It's kind of the pulse that kind of runs through this whole movie, but it's also like this, like, undercurrent. It's the thing that's just below the surface throughout this whole movie. Because, you know, she's fighting for her job. That's the primary thrust of the movie. But she probably wouldn't be in a position where she'd have to fight for her job if she wasn't, you know, out of work with depression. And then, you know, the depression is what makes it so it's like, you know, maybe the movie would be one day if she was just like able to get through all these 16 people in the one day, instead of having to wrestle with, you know, how it feels to be told no by somebody and how it feels to, you know, question her worth and her value. So yeah, I mean, I think I would call it I probably would lean more on the side of calling it a workplace movie, but it's not the movie. The movie isn't the movie it is without the issue of dealing with overcoming your own, working through your own problems and trying to find a way to come out on top. Which for me, I think she does. I think there's a sense of victory that she has in leaving.
Yeah. Because at the end of the movie, she says, like, we're going to be okay, like on the phone. Yeah. So, like, you can already tell she's taking a bigger step towards, like, who she should be or where she should be. So,
yeah. And it's almost like she's been emboldened by the people that have sided with her and emboldened by, you know, realizing, you know, maybe like you said, Derek, that it's the bottom line that this company is more interested in, the headcount instead of the people. And, you know, maybe she realizes now that there's a better job out there. She mentions over the phone that she's going to start, you know, turning in applications right away. So it's like, you know, she can find something better to do. It sucks that she had to go through all of this, but I think she realizes that her she's worth more than what this experience has kind of put her through. I wanted to bring up a point here that was mentioned by our good buddy Steven from the State Theater, that I think is the kind of beating heart of the movie. I think maybe you said, Blake, that the anchor, and that is Manu, her husband, who throughout all of it, he kind of, you know, recenters her and refocuses her, even as she kind of hits her lowest. Derek, what are your thoughts on, and I wish I could tell you this actor's name off the top of my head.
I've got it.
Yeah. What's
Fabrizio,
his name?
Fabrizio Rangione.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish I could pronounce, Italian names. It's a very, he delivers, in my opinion, a very great performance, very essential. What were your thoughts on his performance and kind of the role of the husband in this drama?
Yeah. I mean, he's obviously a very solid anchor of support through it. You know, she's often he's driving her to and fro some of these locations where she needs to go in order to meet with these people. If we tie it into the workplace thing, there's a bit of a to-do made about the fact that he kind of works as a chef in this like fast casual fast food place called anonymously Lunch Garden. So there's that too. And obviously kind of, you know, the sounding board, you know, when she has her struggles, as you were talking about, and I'll just get this point out of here as well. When we got to the scene where, you know, she downs all the Xanax pills, I was a little bit scared, not necessarily for her character, but I was afraid of the tone of the movie being disrupted. Mm-hmm. It sounded like this about to make this very melodramatic mm-hmm. turn. But I think the way the end of that scene pays off, you know, where Anne, who's kind of got this little side arc in the movie as well, comes by to say, "Oh yeah, I'm going to vote for you." And then Sandra immediately says to Manu, "Oh, I took all the pills.
Yeah.
Let's go vomit. Let's go vomit."
Yeah.
You know, and if you're not there to watch your loved one vomit, then, you know, how could you be an anchor of support? So there you go.
Yeah. Blake, your thoughts on Manu, on the husband there.
Yeah, you know, like, great performance. We keep using the word ordinary, and I don't want it to sound like a pejorative.
Right.
But like, he's, like, the characters created in this movie are just so relatable, and, like, they're just normal people. And, you know, Manu is sort of like this, I kept, like, thinking of him as, like, a North Star, where, like, Sandra could kept refocusing her energy towards, you know, like, he never talked down to Sandra. He never was rude to her, but he was very stern with her and kind of like realistic, sort of like, you know, if you don't do this, you know, we can't pay the mortgage, you know? And, and then, very realistic person, human being. And, I mean, we kind of get a lot of these type of performances in European movies where things seem to be more grounded in a reality versus American pictures. And I thought the performance was very good.
Yeah. Yeah. There's that scene in the movie where she says that, you know, our marriage is going to end. Like, you're going to leave me. You don't love me anymore. You just feel pity. And I feel like, A, that's a really good encapsulation of mental illness too, because she, I think she doubts herself so much that she doubts the relationship. And from what we've seen on screen the whole time, I don't think he's ever given the audience a reason to kind of doubt the strength of their relationship. And he expresses, you know, his disappointment and things about the relationship, but he is there for her. The entire movie, he is there for her. And I don't ever feel like, I don't ever feel like the relationship is at risk. I always feel like there's a chance that it's going to bounce back. I think it's going to recover, and they're going to be there for each other. And I think that's a lot on his shoulders of being steadfast the entire movie. And it's not so much that he I try and think of it as like the he's not a knight in shining armor. Like he's not trying to save the day for her, but he wants her to do it herself. Like he wants her to find the strength to do the stuff that she needs to do so that she can overcome these obstacles, so that she can face this terrible thing that's happened to her and be strong and get through it. And I think it's nice to kind of have that kind of a character in the movie, like someone who's just there as moral support. There's not a high moment of drama where he has this show-stopping monologue where he tells her about the importance of, you know, why she has to do this. He tells her why it needs to be done. Like they'll lose their house. They're not going to be able to pay their mortgage. Like, but it's not, like you said, like it's not ever anything where it's just life. It just is. And I feel like in a film like this, that's exactly what you need. You need something to just be right there, mm-hmm. right out there, not super dramatic, just lay out the facts. And I feel like that's what's going to help sell the movie a lot more, is making it so grounded and making mm-hmm. it feel so relatable. And I think that's why it stands out in my head as something that's such a strong and wonderful movie. So I'm trying to think if there's anything else I want to make sure. Is there anything that you guys really want to particularly dive into with the rest of this movie?
I just wanted to shout out Sandra drinking wine for like lunch at this restaurant that Manu works at, like just pure European drinking wine during lunch. France.
And then like there's the mother or mother-in-law who is there as well,
yeah.
who doesn't have a line. And at one point,
she's just there.
Yeah, just reaches for the hand and like doesn't get to make contact because she pulls back or leaves the table. And I'm just like, oh, okay. So we've got mom here just for moral support, and she doesn't have to say anything. I don't even know if that's who it was, but there was the older lady who was at the table, and I was just kind of like, we're not going to go on this character's journey. It's not about you, mom. Little things like that. But I'm trying to think if there was anything else. I like the story with, Alphonse. Yeah. His story where it's like, he is the one of the contracted employees. So if they hire her back, he probably is the one that's going to get fired. He's probably going to be
that
the one
who's getting fired no matter what after this movie. I mean,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I feel like that's coming. When his contract is up, they will not seek to renew it because he took her side, and that's not what they want. So, yeah, I feel bad for him, but I really enjoyed that portion of the story because we're starting to, you're starting to wind down here, starting to really, narrow down who's voting which way, and it really explains why he could be on the fence, why he might not want to vote for her, because his entire livelihood is at stake. And where does he go next? What's his next option? I really like that sequence and kind of going with that character. Anything else you want to touch upon with this movie?
I did want to call out the side plot with Anne, because there's a whole arc of, they first go to her house, and she's like, okay, I got to discuss it with my husband. And the husband gets pissy about it and throws her out. And then it becomes the whole thing of Sandra saying, well, you can stay over at our place. And then she ends up riding with them into the night for the final visits on Sunday night. And then even after she gets canned, she's like, yep, you can still stay over at our place Monday night. That's fine. It's not a huge arc because, again, as you mentioned, obviously the focus has to be on Sandra and all this, but the way that kind of glimmers through and shows, her concern for a fellow employee, I thought that was kind of striking as well.
Yeah, and it ends with the, like, this is the first decision I've ever made for myself. I just think that was, yeah.
I also really liked that, if we can go back to Manu just really quickly. Yeah. Like, he, One of my favorite scenes with him is where she's like, "Where are you going?" And he's like, "We're going back to her house to like make sure, you know, we got her on our side." You know, he's the one that takes the initiative to drive Sandra back there to get that vote. So,
yeah, because doesn't she say like, "Oh, they'll call," or she'll, "Oh, they'll just wait for their call," and he's like, "No, no, we're gonna go. We're gonna ask.
You're they told gonna, us you're 1 p.m. and we're gonna."
Just I really enjoy this movie. I really think it's something special, and it's something special for being something that's, again, not to use it as a disparaging word, but it's a simple premise that really goes a long way. I think this is great, and I hope if you didn't see it last night, you should definitely see it. Is it Sunday night when this one is?
That's right. Yep. Yes.
Sunday at 7. So definitely check it out. Are you guys ready to dive into the second movie?
Yeah.
All right. So the second movie, the bonus movie for the Movies You Should See series, is Safety Last. This is the silent comedy from 1923, starring Harold Lloyd as a guy from a small town who goes to the big city and starts to work for a big, huge retail store so that he can gain the means to help bring the love of his life to the city. It's not going so well. instead of making the money at work, he has to sell off things and then buy these like expensive gifts to show that he's being successful. And his girl back home decides that she is going to go visit him at the city. And they, when she does visit him at the store, she kind of he kind of goes through this whole comedy of errors to prove his position at the store. All of this culminating in a way to bring customers in the store by having one of his friends, who proved earlier in the film, in a like evading the police, that he is able to free climb a building. And so he has decided that he will free climb this department store. And then, due to a mix up, Harold Lloyd's character has to climb this building in a thrilling climax to the motion picture. A silent comedy, Safety Last. What did you guys, how did you guys feel about Safety Last? Derek, I think I will start with you on this one, since I started with Blake last time. What were your thoughts on Safety Last?
Yeah, I was blown away with this. Yeah. It's hard not to be wowed by the sheer physical insanity of the gags, you know, not even like the death defying stuff, but even just like some of these complicated gags that are going on in the department store, or even like, you know, at the very beginning of this movie, when you've got the whole thing of like, oh, Harold Lloyd's behind bars and I see a noose and he's probably going to get bumped off. Oh no, he's not getting about to be bumped off. He's just going to take the train to the big city. And when you have a fake out like that, that actually plays that well, I'm like, okay, this movie has my attention.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, and I think I should back up a little bit, because, you know, even if you haven't seen this movie, you know the image of Harold Lloyd hanging off the clock. Mm-hmm. It's ingrained in culture. It's been spoofed many times, including Back to the Future. And so I was really looking forward to the opportunity to finally knock this off the list and finally understand where this came from. And it's was honestly just a pleasure just to watch Harold Lloyd do all this crazy, crazy stuff. You know, obviously a lot of it is special effects and stuff like that, but there's also a lot of crazy derring do. And of course, the more I researched into Harold Lloyd and saw just how bold and daring he was, we'll get to the hand thing here, I'm sure, at some point, but just to know all that going in here is like, this guy's insane, but he's making me laugh. So
yeah. Blake, what were your thoughts on Safety Last?
Derek brought up my favorite gag, which is the immediate like behind bars with the noose thing. I thought that was a wonderful, like, sort of inventive visual gag amongst like hundreds of thousands of visual gags in this movie.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed it. A lot really funny. not to jump too far ahead, but it has to be said that like him climbing the building is like 30 minutes of the movie, which is right.
And this is only 75 minutes, so that's a huge chunk.
Maybe I'm exaggerating, but it certainly felt like it. But it felt like equally long, but at the same time, there was so much going on with the reason of him having to go that mm-hmm. long up, it was like supremely entertaining. So this is my first Harold Lloyd Christmas or Lloyd Christmas, my favorite, my first Harold Lloyd movie. So I'm excited to have this as my first one.
Yeah. I selected this one because I am like, if I were to have my crown jewel, and it's not like it's a shock to anyone who the silent comedian trifecta is for me, because it's probably the silent comedian trifecta for everybody. But you have Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, and Harold Lloyd. And I think Harold Lloyd is often kind of the forgotten one. He didn't quite reach the anywhere near the levels of success as Chaplin. And
he's the Brian De Palma of like Scorsese and Spielbergers.
Right. Yeah. he's that third wheel, the one that got left behind, which is too bad because all of the movies of his that I've seen are just wonderful. And I think when it came down to choosing one, it's a good idea to go with the one that I think is probably arguably his most famous, certainly includes his most famous sequence, which is the climbing the tower or climbing the store. But yeah, I find this movie to be delightful. Again, this is another thing where I was like, what have I not covered yet? What movies were not included here? And I didn't have a comedy. And it's like, I could go with my go-to comedy, which is just the comedy that I'll put on all the time, which is just I Love You, Man. Like I just enjoy that movie. Or I could go with something different, kind of stretch the cinematic muscles a little bit and have people sit through a movie with no talking. And that's what I decided to do, would go with Safety Last. But I think people will be able to overlook the no talking aspect of this movie by watching a 75 minutes of physical gags and just incredible like stunt work that just is still mind-blowing after all this time. Like it's just amazing to watch, and because it looks so seamless when you watch the making of and kind of how they talk about how this movie was made, it's still pretty risky. Like even if there were trickery involved, there were still some pretty impressive feats that were being pulled off here. And I just think this is, for a 100-year-old movie, this is just still an incredible piece of cinema, and just hilarious. Like I found myself just laughing out loud during this movie. So I hope that other people are able to do that too. I hope that people are willing to give this movie a chance, because as this movie or as this episode is being released, this movie has not played at the state yet. It'll play Saturday and Sunday matinees. So let's sell this movie to people. What stands out about this movie for you, Blake? What is the kind of like driving force behind this movie that would help you or that you think would motivate people to go see it in a theater?
Well, I think this movie is going to play really well in a crowd because there's literally like a gag per minute, maybe even every 30 seconds there's a gag. And not only that, but I feel like I don't want to say this is like the genesis of like film language or like setting up like a gag, like a visual gag, but like a lot of this stuff, I think in this movie, people will just like watch and understand like setup, payoff, like in term, like there's a great, one of my favorite parts of the movie is when like the landlord comes for rent and they get in these big coats and then they just like suck themselves up and they disappear. And it's just like things like that like people will just like have a ball with this movie, you know, like I mean, I think if I were to sell to people, it'd be like if you were to come to the State Theater 50, 60 years ago, this would be like a matinee you could go to, maybe even like a regular one, and you're able to sort of like go back in time with this movie, not only like with the actual movie itself, but maybe like even you can transport yourself to like the what the theater was doing back then. And I just think like even I think even wow, this is tough. Maybe even kids might get a little bit of a kick out of this. Maybe like 10 or 12 year olds. I think going younger than that, it might be a little too much. But like I just think this is like a like a it's just a classic comedy, a movie on like a visual a storytelling base that like people would just really will really get along with.
Derek, your thoughts on selling this movie, or what would be the driving factor that you think would help get people into the theater to see this one?
Yeah, I think there are several things. We kind of touched upon like the Daredevil stuff, and that's not even limited to just the stuff climbing. There's a very early on sequence where like he's trying to get onto a streetcar and he's ultimately hanging onto the streetcar, and then he's ultimately trying to get off the streetcar onto another moving vehicle that's kind of chaotic in its own right. And I will do a quick sidebar here that they showed a modern trailer. For Safety Last in front of this past weekend's movies at the State. And you know, they showed a lot of the great moments. They showed like the coat hanging moment that Blake mentioned, and they showed the streetcar to the car scene that I mentioned. They even showed the final shot of the movie, which I was kind of surprised. Spoilers, but I'm not going to reveal that there. So there's that. There's also a we should also mention there's a good chunk of this movie that's kind of related to just chaotic retail salesperson humor, and just like hundreds of ladies going wild trying to get frocks and gloves and stuff like that, and trying to find, you know, the crazy inventors like, oh, he's cutting the cloth. Oh, wait, that was the manager's coat. Well, just inventive stuff like that just keeps popping up and just finding some new twist on that piece. The other thing I want to give credit to specifically with the end sequence is I really love the comedic build to it. Because it's like, how do you narratively justify this guy who definitely does not climb these buildings, because it establishes that his friend, quote, Limpy Bill, end quote, does that. And I just love the build of it because they have to go like to subterfuge because Limpy Bill is still evading this cop that, you know, he avoided the first time by climbing up the whole building. And so they set up this whole thing of like Limpy Bill saying, okay, you just climb up the first floor, you climb into the second floor window, we'll swap places and I'll take it the rest of the way. And then they get to the second floor and it's like, sorry, I can't get in here. Go up to the third floor. And the way they just naturally keep evolving that situation to get to the point where it's like, sooner or later, he's just going up the whole damn thing. That really was inventive. And I'm like, it's a real sustained way of laughter and tension at the same time, which is cool.
The obstacles that he faces as he climbs this, like on each floor, like there are little situations that he has to kind of get through. Like there's a dog on one floor, there's a people watching him on one floor that kind of fills the
Rooting him
like,
on.
yeah, cheering him on. And they kind of, because they're in front of the window cheering him on, the other guy can't get to the window to swap out. And he says, you know, you climb, I'll take your hat, you know, once you get there, and they'll never even recognize that it's a different person. It's such a like you said earlier, the setup. Here comes the setup for the joke, here comes the joke. One of my favorite little bits in the movie, and I think it's just because from working retail and having to experience those nightmares, there is a scene where I believe it's like almost closing time or almost lunchtime, and there's a lady there who wants to buy some fabric. And she like, yes. So Harold's pulling one of the reams of fabric off. No, not that one. Let me see this other one. No, not that one. Let me see this other one. To the point where he pulls down all of them, and then she's like, ah, never mind. So he has to put all of them.
I wanted back. The first one.
She wanted the right. original yeah. one. Yeah,
right. That's right.
For, she wanted the first and then one. She wants it just for a sample.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Yes. It's like, I felt that pain too.
just the rage from that. Like, I just think that was so smart. I also really like before he starts to climb the building, he like somebody writes kick me yes. backwards.
He does.
He writes kick me backwards on the wall and gets the cop pushed up against it. And then the cop has this perfect kick me on his back. And like there's a guy in the crowd who's there to watch the climbing. And there he kicks him. And it's like, oh, just such a funny moment. I want to talk about something about this movie that, of course, it would be something that I would talk about with this movie because, you know, I'm that guy. So watching this movie, which is 100 years old from a different period in time, sometimes films from a different age handle people differently. Kind of treat people in a certain way and kind of rely on their the prejudices of the time. And I think this movie has a couple of issues where it leans into some racial and cultural prejudices dealing with one of the black service workers at the store, where he's kind of like, they have him like climb up on top of this ladder scared. And there's an imagery that is conveyed there that I felt a little uncomfortable with. And then there is a shop owner that is he selling the locket? He's selling something or buying something, who I think is represents a Jewish store clerk. And they haggle over the finances and the amount of money that the Harold is going to receive. And I feel like, you know, I think it's an issue because, of course, it is. Like, it's now, you know, looking through the lens of like 100 years later and how we handle races and cultures, that's wrong. But I think it's also you have to look at it through the lens of if we erase it, we're not going to learn anything from it. If we don't show it, we're not going to learn anything from it. So I think kind of seeing that these movies were created in a different time and aren't perfect, I think it's important to see. And I think that this movie still has merit, still has value, even with those. And again, this is probably, this is something that I noticed because, of course, I would notice this. I'm that guy. But I wanted to bring that up and make sure that was discussed and see if that was something that you guys caught from it or if it was something that even stood out to you guys.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely noticed. I don't even know how to say this. I missed the part with the person buying the locket or whatever, but yeah. Definitely, you know, one of the great gags of the movie involves a black man who sort of like gets really freaked out and runs up. I forget what it is, but he's in the corner of the ceiling. Hiding, and he just has that face of like he's such a weak human being, and I it's a comedic gag, and I understand why it's there, and I understand your reservations with it, and I would be lying if I didn't feel something similar.
But I
don't necessarily look at it. I don't know how to say this without like offending somebody. To me it really didn't, it wasn't like an intentionally offensive, I don't know,
right,
like it's
right,
it wasn't,
it doesn't
like
completely
a,
derail things.
You know, like it's but I won't lie, I had that thought where I was like, oh, like why is this guy the one who's up scared of this ghost. Like there's literally women who are like, oh, you're scared of this thing? And it's like, you know, so I get it. I get it. Yeah. And I'm with you. Like, I don't think these things should be erased from movies. So I'm kind of glad it's still there.
Right.
But yeah, it was kind of like a, man, that doesn't age well. I think that's what I say to myself is like, ah, that doesn't, that's not, you know, who we are anymore. But
right.
Yeah.
It's important to know that it's an artifact of a different time. And, you know, that's not saying that racism doesn't still exist, but it's just saying that the way that this is happening, the way that this is being shown on screen.
It's not mainstream movies anymore. Yeah.
Right. And that's, I think it's important to see that, from a historical context, and like Derek, like you said, I don't think it derails the movie at all, because once it happens, we move past it. It just feels like it's this, you know, from a 100 years of context, it feels like it's this bump in the road that we've got to get over. And then there's really great stuff to come. We just have to, you know, have to deal with it with our sensibilities, but kind of take ourselves back at the time when, you know, it didn't have the same impact. You know, that's all I'm going to say. I'm going to get us out of this hole one way or the other that I dug for us.
I'm up.
That's right. Derek, what were some of your other thoughts on this movie with this? Cause I think this was your first, was this the first Harold Lloyd movie for you or?
That's right. That's right. And I will admit, I've actually pulled my other three Harold Lloyd Criterion Blu-rays in the hopes that I'll probably will watch at least one of these before our next episode, just for that. Cause I've done some digging there. Some of these movies like Speedy sound especially awesome. And we'll definitely want to check those out.
Derek, can you name those really quick?
Yeah. So we have The Kid Brother. That's from 1927. Let's see here. It's kind of like a Western riff. There's The Freshman from 1925, which is like, you know, him going to college, playing football. Mm. And then there's the movie he made last of these four movies, which is Speedy from 1928, which is kind of like him romping through New York. It's got a Babe Ruth cameo in it. It's got some, it's supposedly it ends with like a big chase sequence. So those are good. Each of these Harold Lloyd Blu-rays also have like restored shorts of his as well on top of that. So I was kind of impressed to see like how much of his like prime era stuff is in the collection at this point.
Yeah. I've seen The Freshman and I've seen Speedy. I don't remember Speedy. I watched it one night when I was working, so I probably didn't pay as much attention as I wished I could have. But I remember The Freshman being very, very funny, very, very good movie. That's another really good one. But yeah, I think I'm probably going to try, because these movies are short, like they're breezy, easy watches. So I think I might try to kind of get through some more of the Harold Lloyd filmography, maybe before we meet again, except our next assignment, will have us watch multiple movies. So who knows what happens.
The other thing I want to call out quick is, as if this movie didn't impress me enough with its fortitude. I don't know if Blake knows the story. I'm sure Andy knows the story, but several years before he made Safety Last, he was doing this photo shoot and he took what he thought was a prop bomb and lit it with his cigarette and blew off his thumb and part of his finger with that. Yeah. So when he's doing all these climbing stunts in the movie, he's only doing it with 8 fingers, not 10. He's wearing like this glove that kind of like, at least from like 1920s black and white techniques, will look like a hand on camera, but his right hand only has 3 fingers on it. So. Man.
The Safety Last, indeed.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't know that until I was kind of watching the some of the special features that go along with this movie, and I think it was the behind the scenes kind of talking about how that last scene was filmed, and they mention it there, and it's just like all the more impressive because. You know, how do you grip these things when you're missing the finger that kind of sets us apart from other animals, that helps us with that grip? Just incredible. Yeah, I think it comes as no surprise as I select this for the series that I absolutely love this movie, and just find it to be super entertaining, and I hope that it opens people's eyes up to you know, silent comedy and just kind of how great silent comedies can be. I'm a big Buster Keaton fan as well. And I think the three, Chaplin, Keaton, and Lloyd, are just titans of that era, and have movies that are still really entertaining to watch today. Blake, did you have any other items or things that you wanted to talk about with this movie?
I don't think so.
Yeah. Derek, anything else?
The only thing I'm going to throw out there is, if we haven't made enough of a case for you to see this movie yet, it is free to watch this weekend if you are a State Theater member.
Yes. If you are a member of the State Theater, your admission cost is nothing but your time. And this is a 75-minute movie, you know, just a quick watch Saturday and Sunday. I believe Saturday is 2 o'clock and Sunday is 1. Is that right?
That is correct.
Excellent. And yeah, you will not want to miss this. Just like, it's sure to be a wonderful experience at the theater. You know, getting to see this classic of the era and kind of seeing it in a theater that is like the theaters of that time, you know, with better seating. You know, getting to see it there is just an incredible experience. So I hope you go. I hope you enjoy it.
I've seen two silent movies at the State Theater since they reopened, and they've both have been two of my favorite screenings.
Which ones did you end up seeing?
The first one, Derek and I saw Metropolis on that like single Sunday night showing with like 50 other people, and it was incredible. Yeah. And then the other one was when City Lights played, the Charlie Chaplin movie. I went with my mom, and we both were just like laughing so hard at that movie. So I can't recommend enough sitting on that floor and looking up at an old movie. It's the best experience that you're gonna have on a Saturday afternoon, or a Sunday afternoon for that matter.
I'm looking forward to it. I'm hoping that I'm able to make it out for one of the screenings of Safety Last, just because I want to see this movie on the big screen and see if there are other people there who see what their reaction is to it, because it's a really good time. So, but I think that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the Criterion Break. I think before we do our little plugs, I'm going to shout out our own show. And talk about what we're going to do next. So we are about to start our second filmmaker series, and we are going to go through the complete box set of Wong Kar-wai. That is what, seven movies in that box set, is that right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right. So we're going to go through all seven of the films included in that box set. Some of them, I think, some of us have seen before. Some of them, none of us have seen before. So I think it'll be a fun experience for the three of us to kind of go through that. And we will tackle our first set of movies in February with our episode of the Criterion Break. So follow along with us in your book. I think we're going to probably cover the first three movies in the box set on that first episode, which would be what?
I think we should do the first two.
First two? Okay, cool. Yeah.
The first two are As Tears Go By and Days of Being Wild.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Excellent. The only reason is because the next two are kind of like semi sequels to each other. So I think those should be viewed in one sitting. So
yeah, that sounds good to me. I'm all for it. So perfect. Well, we will start off with those films as we continue our Criterion Break and start off our filmmaker series for 2023, Wong Kar Wai. Very exciting. Derek, where can people find you online if they would like to get to know you a little better?
Yeah, you can find me on the Letterboxd at D-E-R-V Dude. That's Derv Dude. At Letterboxd, I'm on the same handle on the Instagram. You can find me on the Facebook as well. So yeah, and you'll find me watching these two movies at the State Theater this weekend, along with a bunch of others in the weeks to come. It's a very exciting time over there.
It's been a busier month than I think anyone expected. I think when Stephen talked to me about doing this series, he was like, you know, January's kind of slow. I don't feel like January has been very slow, except for a blizzard. Getting hit with that has kind of taken a lot of the joy out of some things. But hey,
we missed your in-person intros, Andy.
Telling you. I'm glad, like around 8 o'clock, I was glad that I didn't go, but at about 6:30, I was like, why am I not going? But at 8 o'clock, I was like, yep, glad I wasn't there. Blake, where can people find you online and your thoughts on various feature films?
You can follow me on Instagram at BlakeG5150 if you want to. Otherwise, I like Derek, I also have a Letterboxd account, The Real John G. And if you are at the State Theater, I sometimes work there. So you come say hi.
Yeah.
He's got a shirt and everything now. It's great.
He does. He's got a shirt now.
I do. Yeah. I after my initial training form must have been longer than I thought it was going to be, because I finally just got my shirt about 2 weeks ago or so. So pretty exciting stuff.
They only give you the shirt after you pass the test. So yeah. I think you did it.
I just wish I knew what test that was. That's right. The thing. So
yeah. So it doesn't come back to get you later.
You're right.
Before I plug all of the Fat Dude universe, I do want to throw a shout out to friends of the program, Casey Kelderman and Sam Lenz, who have returned to the podcasting world with their horror-based podcast, Screams from the Basement, where two guys who love horror films dive into that world and talk about, you know, what's coming, what they've seen compared with other movies. It's just kind of a nice, you know, a nice little haunt, a nice little bit of horror from two guys who are, first off, are a ton of fun to listen to, know their stuff, and are just, what a couple of good dudes, those guys. So yeah, Screams from the Basement. I think I got that right. Yeah. Screams from the Basement. Yep. And you can find it, I think, anywhere you get your podcasts. I know they're running it off of Anchor, but I think you can still find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Follow all things Fat Dude Digs Flicks on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Letterboxd, YouTube, TikTok. All you have to do is do a search for Fat Dude Digs Flicks, and you will find me there. Letterboxd? Did I say Letterboxd? I'm saying Letterboxd now, just in case I didn't.
Gotta cover the bases.
Yeah, I know. I don't want anybody to miss Letterboxd. It's awesome. Subscribe to this podcast. Like this podcast. Rate, review this podcast. Share this podcast with your friends. I am going to keep doing this podcast for as long as these two guys will continue to do it with me. And we're going to do that if we have 3 listeners or 300 listeners or even more. Of course, we would like to have more listeners. And the best way to do that is with your help. So please leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or just share it with your friends so they know that we're out here. If you subscribe to this podcast, not only do you get the Criterion Break, but you also get Let's Talk About, which is an interview show where I am joined by a guest to talk about their life, their loves, and a movie that has had an impact on them. I am thrilled to announce that on next week's show, I am joined by the lead singer of one of my favorite bands of all time, Ryan Miller of Guster, where we talk about his life, the formation of Guster, the longevity of Guster, and what it's like to work on film scores. And we talk about some recent movies that he's watched that he enjoys, or ones that he didn't quite get into that he wants to give another shot. So just a really fun chat with Ryan Miller. Just a blast. So you can catch that next week right here. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, recommendations, would like to be a guest on this show or let's talk about, send an email to fatdudediggsflicks@gmail.com. I think that's it. Oh, the South Dakota Film Community Group. Make sure you follow the South Dakota Film Community Group on Facebook. Join in the conversation if you live in South Dakota. If you don't live in South Dakota and just want to find a nice group of people to talk about movies with, that's a good place to start. The South Dakota Film Community Group on Facebook. That's all I've got to plug. That's it. That's everything. Guys, this was a lot of fun. As always, I really enjoy it. I look forward to doing Criterion Breaks so very much because you guys humor me in a way that I just appreciate. Thank you for watching these movies that I've kind of forced you to watch.
Over the last You picked great month. Movies, Andy.
You got lucky this time.
Yeah, I know. I feel like the turnaround here is that you guys somewhere down the road should pick a lineup of movies that we have to watch as well. I think that's the way to do this.
I'm hoping Ad Astra gets added to the collection at some point. And yeah,
James Gray is due.
It's gonna be a struggle. Who wants to tell these lovely people good night for us?
I just said good night in my silent movie voice. So yeah,
that was good. Bye. Yeah. You've been listening to The Criterion Break. Listening to Fat Dude Digs.